Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The state is proposing to expand a road through Nenana traditional territories, hunting and fishing grounds.
Alaska Native activists block the road to a state agriculture project. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, remembering former Alaska Governor Bill Sheffield.
The most important thing to know about Bill Sheffield is he loved Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A quick warning, this story contains accounts of sexual violence and child sexual abuse. A traffic stop last night ended a day-long search for a man accused of kidnapping and sexually assaulting a teen girl at gunpoint in Wasilla. Alaska state troopers say 49-year-old David Wayne Anderson faces numerous charges including kidnapping, attempted murder, and sexual abuse of a minor. Troopers say Anderson was driving a pickup when he abducted the 13-year-old girl Wednesday. She was walking home from her bus stop. According to a charging document, she told troopers the suspect tried to make her smoke meth, put a blanket over her head, and bound her wrists with duct tape. Charges say a lab test found proof of the sexual assault. The girl told troopers she chewed through the tape on her wrists to free herself. She got to a road and got help from a passing driver, the charges say. Investigators matched descriptions of the suspect and truck to Anderson, a convicted sex offender. After a traffic stop, troopers say Anderson confessed to the assault. Earlier this week, activists blocked a road leading into the Nenana-Tochacket Agricultural Project for 2 days. Members of Alaska-based Native Movement set up the blockade after work began on a road leading into the ag project, located just west of Nenana. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the activists want state officials to reconsider their plans for both the road and ag project.
Going live.
Fairbanks Native Rights Advocate Inay Begay shared an on-scene report of the blockade on Facebook soon after protesters set it up Monday morning at the entrance to a bridge over the Nenana River that leads into a big agricultural project on the other side.
The state is proposing to expand a road through Nenana traditional territories, hunting and fishing grounds, and it's gotten to the point now where construction is about to start and a tribe is out here blockading the road.
Begay is executive director of Native Movement, an Alaska-based nonprofit that promotes social justice and sustainability through indigenous environmental practices. Members of the organization and their local allies say the state is moving too quickly to develop the 140,000-acre Nenana-Tochacket agricultural project, so they blocked the road leading into the area just as the contractor apparently was about to begin work.
So the tribe asked Native Movement to organize and physically blockade the bridge before any equipment could be moved across to the road.
Native Movement Environmental Justice Coordinator Lindsay Maylard and fellow members of the group participated in the blockade, along with others from the Nenana Native Association and the Village Council. She said they wanted to prevent construction equipment from entering the ag project, but allow locals in to trap, cut firewood, and other traditional uses.
Anyone could go through, but we are just not wanting the equipment to make it to the other side.
Our construction team was not on site, meaning we weren't crossing the bridge.
State Transportation Department spokesperson Danielle Tessin says the activity the protesters saw was preparation for the project by Bryce, the Anchorage-based contractor that was awarded the $5.8 million contract to improve the 12-mile road into the Tuchacket. A second phase of the project would extend the road another 19 miles to the Kantishna River.
Crews are mobilizing equipment and we're working around the construction site at our material sites, which is what we do at the start of any construction project.
Tessin says DOT and contractor representatives decided to delay moving ahead on the project after meeting with local residents and tribal members to talk about their concerns.
We've been taking time to really reflect on that conversation and that learning session that we had. And we will be hosting another listening session that will be open to the public.
Tessin says that meeting will be held later this month, and DOT is still working on when and where it'll happen. Maylard says Native Movement would welcome more talks, and she assumes local tribal officials would be too. But Nenana Native Association First Chief Carolyn Ketzler wasn't available Thursday to comment. Tessin says officials with other state agencies involved in the project also may be invited. That likely would include the Department of Natural Resources, which is overseeing the ag project. But DNR officials didn't respond to requests for comment Thursday. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Former Alaska Governor Bill Sheffield died this morning at his home in Anchorage. He was 94. Sheffield, a lifelong Democrat, was the state's fifth governor.
The most important thing to know about Bill Sheffield is he loved Alaska.
That's John Pugh, one of Sheffield's close friends who came to Anchorage to spend time with him in his final weeks. Pugh led the state's Department of Health and Social Services under Sheffield and maintained a close friendship with him long after he lost his reelection.
To his dying day, that was his message to each of us who were friends and his message to anybody who would listen to him is, let's work together to make Alaska a great place to live and continue to make improvements to Alaska for all Alaskans.
Sheffield was born in Spokane, Washington in 1928. He grew up during the Great Depression on a small family farm. He came to Alaska in 1953 to sell and service home appliances. Before becoming governor, Sheffield founded a business that eventually owned 19 hotels across Alaska and in Whitehorse, Yukon. He later sold that business to Holland America. He served as governor from 1982 to 1986. Friends credit his administration with a number of accomplishments, including completing the state's takeover of the Alaska Railroad from the federal government, shepherding state financing for a road and port system for the Red Dog Mine in northwest Alaska, and implementing a pay system for public employees that contributed to pay equity for women. According to friends, Sheffield lost his reelection bid after he slashed state budgets to deal with a crash in oil prices, and after a corruption probe where a criminal indictment and political impeachment were considered, but never materialized. Memorial services will be announced at a later time. Coming up, a California tech company is making lab-grown salmon, but at least one fisherman is skeptical.
I can't imagine this lab-produced flesh is going to taste anything like wild Alaska salmon.
At least one is skeptical. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Voting in the general election? Here are key deadlines you need to know. First, in-person voting begins on October 24th. Want to vote absentee? You must request your ballot by October 29th. Last is Election Day. You must vote or submit your ballot by November 8th. Visit elections.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
The recent closure of the Bering Sea snow crab and red king crab fisheries has some coastal Alaska towns taking a hard look at their futures. As KUCB's Maggie Nelson reports, the remote Pribilof Island of St. Paul is coming up with some creative ways to soften the looming economic blow.
The economy in St. Paul is built around harvesting and processing snow crab. Now, the island is bracing for a major hit. City manager Philip Zavadil says the effects of the crab closure will be felt far beyond the community of about 350 people.
We're feeding the world with crab and halibut and salmon. That needs to be recognized.
St. Paul's Trident Seafoods is one of the largest crab processing plants in the world. And last year saw the largest crash in snow crab that the industry remembers. The disappearance is somewhat of a mystery, but many researchers point to climate change as the likely culprit. And when the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced in October that Bering Sea snow crab would be closed for the first time in the fishery's history, and Red King crab would shut down for a second season in a row, Zavadil knew St. Paul would be in trouble. So he sat down with other city officials, and they hit the drawing board.
So trying to get creative and have people understand that this is going to happen more and more, and that we need to address it and do something now.
Rather than just reach out to state and federal officials for help, which they've also done, the city has declared a cultural, economic, and social emergency. The resolution isn't your usual fisheries disaster declaration. It outlines the island's history and its reliance on the snow crab harvest, and Zavadil says it's sort of like a natural disaster declaration. But it's anticipating a coming emergency and the negative impacts that could have on things like critical infrastructure as well as cultural roots.
Trying to be proactive rather than reactive.
The small island government is expecting a $2 million loss in revenue next year. That's a 90% drop in state shared tax revenue. Community organizations like Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association and the local Native Corporation are also expecting big hits. Both estimate revenue reductions of over 90% from last year. Elder Jacob Merkuliev is a longtime resident, subsistence fisher, and the mayor of St. Paul. He says when he first heard that both fisheries would close this season, he was stunned.
The first thing that hit my mind, I said, oh no, what are we going to do?
He says he's worried about the ripple effects the shutdowns will have. He expects drops in school funding as families consider leaving the island, a loss of public safety services, reductions in city employee hours, and a rise in various island-wide taxes. Looking forward, he says, the view is pretty grim.
Hopefully, you know, it doesn't carry on for too many years.
Governor Mike Dunleavy requested a disaster declaration for the closure of the two crab fisheries last month. In a letter to the Secretary of Commerce, he said the shutdowns will cause a loss of around $287 million in Alaska's seafood landings. St. Paul city officials also sent a request for a fisheries disaster declaration to Dunleavy, the Secretary of Commerce, and other delegates. Zavadil says the island's cultural, economic, and social emergency declaration is meant to help those representatives see how important this remote community is to other parts of the nation. Generally, it takes about 2 to 5 years for fisheries relief to get to communities. He hopes this effort can help speed that process up. In Unalaska, I'm Maggie Nelson.
Although wild salmon remains one of Alaska's most lucrative seafood industries, it's also one of the state's most vulnerable as climate change and population growth increase pressure on the world's oceans. As it looks more and more likely that demand will eventually outstrip the productivity of salmon and other wild seafood stocks, researchers have turned to another method for producing protein from fish by culturing it in a lab. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel recently traveled to California to taste some of the world's first lab-produced salmon and sent us this report.
It's a typical overcast morning in San Francisco's Dog Patch neighborhood when I arrive at the headquarters of biotech company Wildtype. In a city known for tech, Wildtype isn't an anomaly. But in the world of sustainable seafood, they're making waves.
Hi. Hey.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hi, good.
I'm Dalton.
Nice to meet you.
Dalton Thomas, the company's head of food service sales, seats me at a kitchen bar. Behind it, an in-house sushi chef prepares me a plate of their product before it hits the U.S. market. Lab-grown salmon.
So that's it.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty wild.
It's pretty nuts. Yeah.
It's a square block of marbled pink flesh, almost indistinguishable from traditional salmon, except this fish has never touched the ocean.
So we have the nigiri version of the Wildtype salmon. It's already brushed with soy sauce, so it's just ready to eat.
Wildtype's fish is intended to be enjoyed raw, a decision made in part because of the sheer size and profitability of the sushi industry, but also because, as Thomas explains, cell-cultured salmon is simply not as appetizing when cooked.
It does taste like fish, which is weird.
It's not weird because it's fish.
It's literally fish. Yeah.
The basic idea is we cultivate real salmon cells, and we combine those with a plant-based scaffold or a sort of a three-dimensional matrix to help create, you know, like a really nice appearance and taste and texture.
That's Justin Kolbeck, co-founder and CEO of the company.
The super cool thing is we've actually been able to replicate, you know, fat and this sort of connective tissue and then the fatty parts without having to use any genetic engineering.
To make this product, technicians harvest stem cells from a wild salmon. Then, in the same way a baker might feed a sourdough starter, they feed the cells with different proteins, amino acids, salts, and sugars. The fish cells mesh with the scaffold, which then directs the cells to grow into fat or tissue, giving the salmon its texture and shape. But Wild Types creators say their mission goes beyond the novelty of growing meat in a lab.
Returning stocks of Pacific salmon in general along the Pacific coast have been declining pretty substantially over the last 40, 50 years. The FAO predicts we're going to need something like 30 million more tons of seafood to satisfy demand by the end of this decade.
Kolbeck says the company's aim is only to supplement the existing seafood industry, not supplant it. The company has even gone so far as to invest in conservation efforts around one of the world's biggest sockeye salmon fisheries in Bristol Bay, Alaska.
I don't think it is a solution as much as a diversion.
Eric Jordan is a multi-generational commercial fisherman. For most of his life, he's made a living trolling for wild salmon in the waters of Southeast Alaska. He says he doesn't believe lab-grown salmon poses a threat to his livelihood, but he does have other concerns.
I can't imagine this lab-produced flesh is going to taste anything like wild Alaska salmon. So I'm not threatened by that. I am concerned about existential climate change threat and trawl bycatch.
Jordan feels a seafood alternative might be taking resources away from the conservation efforts.
There's a lot of places you can invest money to protect wild salmon without investing it in producing an alternative to eat.
But momentum is growing for cell-cultured foods. David Kaplan, a professor of biomedical engineering at Tufts, says Wild Type is far from alone.
In the U.S., there is an incredible number and growing number of companies out there trying to grow just about any food you might want to eat or have eaten.
The Food and Drug Administration has yet to approve any cell-cultured meat for consumption in the U.S. However, approval is expected within the next year. And Wild Type's Kolbeck is banking on the future, hoping to one day transition his cell-cultured salmon from a niche market to something more universal.
It would be amazing if we could make one of nature's healthiest foods so accessible that it would be as, you know, cheap and available as like a Big Mac. That is the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning.
While we may not be seeing the Golden Arches carrying a lab-grown McFish anytime soon, there's no doubt that the landscape of the seafood industry is changing. And cell-cultured salmon will be making its way to the market sooner than later. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction with over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands, whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level. Discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The pandemic offered a unique chance for scientists to sample stress levels in humpback whales around Juneau when there was very minimal tourism activity. Now they're looking to compare that with this year, when tourism was almost back to pre-pandemic levels. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has the story.
This summer, researchers collected samples of the stress hormone cortisol from whales in Juneau waters. Susie Tierlink studies whales and monitors whale watching practices around Juneau through a federal program. She says they take the samples using a dart, which probably feels like a bee sting to the whales.
In blubber, it takes weeks and months to accumulate. And so we're getting more of a cumulative average of what their physiological stress environment has been in the weeks and months prior.
Tierlink says they took those samples from blubber, which stores the hormone longer than blood does.
Generally speaking, after we take a biopsy sample, we do monitor whales for some period of time, and by and large, they go back to what they were doing before.
Yeah.
So we think that it's a pretty small impact.
That also makes sure that the sample doesn't reflect the whale getting temporarily stressed by the dart that takes the sample. A 2019 study used instruments posted on land that observed the whales without influencing their behavior. The instruments record respiratory rates, dive patterns, and speeds of the whales. This tracked the more immediate behavioral differences, minute by minute.
And what they found is that, especially as the number of boats increased, they did see faster swimming speeds, faster rates of respiration, longer downtimes, changes in direction.
That study was led by Heidi Pearson with the University of Alaska Southeast. Pearson is also the lead investigator for this year's stress study.
And so then we realized we had this really golden opportunity to look at humpback whales at a time of reduced vessel traffic.
She said they biopsied 24 whales in total, and that they're using photographic data to track which whales are coming and going.
And so we're also trying to determine if there's a change in residency or how long whales are here each year, and also how many whales are here each year, because we predict that there might be changes in how many whales are here or how long they stay depending on the vessel traffic.
Tierlink, Pearson, and their research group are expecting results from this latest round of data this spring. That will be just in time to help better inform whale watching practices in Juneau for next season. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
What is winter anyway? For a lot of Alaskans, it's a season that's not entirely defined by a specific period on the calendar as much as you know it when you see it. The snow-covered landscape, the frosty breath, maybe sea ice forming on the coastline. It's safe to say we're seeing some of that already this winter, but whether the wintry weather remains is a question people like National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider are pondering. Brettschneider, back for our Ask a Climatologist segment, points to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's long-term forecast for a third La Nina winter in a row. But he says we can't draw too many conclusions from the winter we've seen so far.
So, for example, last winter, November was the coldest month of the winter for many locations in the southwestern, say, quarter of the state. And the thinking was, you know, this is a real harbinger for it's going to be just a brutally cold winter. And it turned out to be, especially in the southern mainland, like a top 10 warmest winter. So we need to keep that in mind. So NOAA just came out with their seasonal outlooks, and they look at a couple of things. There's always going to be uncertainty on what happens on relatively short time scales. We don't know, you know, where the jet stream is going to be and what the trajectory of sea ice is going to be and so on. But the largest contributor to the seasonal forecast is La Nina. And more times than not, La Nina winters are colder than average in Alaska. Not every time, but a majority of times. So that represents about 40% of the variability. Another important factor is the evolution of sea ice in the Chukchi Sea and then the Bering Sea. And it's kind of getting a late start right now. And when that water is open with no ice on it, there's a lot of heat that can be liberated into the atmosphere and it keeps things warm. And then the other thing is trend. The trend is warming. You know, if you just woke up from a coma and someone said, well, do you think it'll be, we think the winter will be like, you should probably say, I don't know, but it's probably going to be warmer than winters used to be, just because things are warmer now. So those are the three things that go into our winter outlook. And if you look at the winter outlook this year, it shows colder than normal temperatures or below normal is favored in southeast Alaska. Above normal temperatures are favored in the west coast and north slope. And that's driven largely by trends, recent trends, and sea ice, and kind of what we call equal chances. So no signal for either above or below for, you know, the other 50% of the state in between southeast and northwest.
You mentioned the trend, and just riffing off of, you know, if you woke up from a coma, What if you had been frozen in ice, you know, hundreds of years ago, and you woke up, you just, you know, thawed out? What would you think was going to happen with the winter?
So let's say, for example, this winter ends up being, and I'm just going to make this number up, 2 degrees colder than normal. Well, if this person had been frozen in ice, you know, 100 years ago, and we replaced that winter 100 years ago with this winter, what we would think of as being cold, they would think of as, whoa, that was a pretty mild winter, just because it used to be a lot colder back then. So we do need to keep that in mind, that there is this temporal perspective. We're now used to this new warmer world. And so if we're a little cooler than our new normal, that still might be much warmer than it used to be in a typical year.
Do you think that person would look around at us now, those of us who have complained about this recent snow and the cold, that they would think that we were wimps?
Snow is trickier. You know, we've managed to hold on to our snow totals over time. Although the snow has been squeezed on average into fewer days of the year. So we start our snow season a little bit later and we end it a little bit earlier. The core snow months are hanging in there and actually have gotten a little bit snowier, but that can only last for so long. You know, eventually, as things continue to warm, we would transition more of that snow into rain, which, you know, I don't know of anyone that likes rain in the winter. It's just nothing good about winter rain.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like we've established that for sure. Getting back to this thought out person bit that I should have let go a long time ago. So maybe it's more like they look around at us complaining, not us, but people who have complained about snow right at the beginning of November. And they would say, well, that's later than it used to be when I was in my prime, a pre-frozen person.
Well, even as recently as several decades ago, if you said, well, what's the snowiest month of the year around Alaska? And for the northern half of the state, October was the snowiest month of the year. That's not the case anymore. There's almost no location where October is the snowiest month. And again, this is like in the 80s and 90s. This isn't like 100 years ago. This is very recently. But now what we're seeing is a lot of what used to fall as snow in October is now falling as rain. So, you know, if you warm things up 3, 4, 5 degrees, you know, what used to be a 30 degree snow is now a 35 degree rain. That's shifted. So that's something that, you know, someone from 100 years ago would probably notice, and the later freeze up of rivers and so on, because the darkness doesn't change. You know, it still gets dark at the same time it did 100 years ago, but we were just not quite as cold.
That's interesting to think about. I didn't anticipate a frozen person coming into this.
But here we are.
But here we are. Well, thanks for bearing with me on that. That was National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider and our Encino man-like imaginary friend. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clinton, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Tosh Kimmel in Sitka, and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.